Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any more sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away." He who was seated on the throne said, "I am making everything new." Then he said, "Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true." Revelation 21.
It doesn't get any better than this. When you think of your best experience or your most treasured place, what comes to mind? Our family has a cabin in the Adirondacks that my dad built about 40 years ago, and I thought I'd show you a few pictures that we can see as we look out the front, and you can see why it's important. That is the view. That's Upper Saranac Lake. If you've been to Young Life, it's about a quarter of a mile up to the left, and we're looking across at islands and mountains. Go ahead, Carrie, run some more of those. We've got a variety of scenes that we've picked, beautiful sunsets, looking down the other way, and then I like this next one. I had to edit about 200 to sort of get just a few of these. There's one that you can see when you can see the clouds below the mountains on the other side. So this brings lots of fond memories for me. And matter of fact, when I was there the last time, I usually try to get a week each summer, and I was standing there and looking out what we call a typical Adirondack day. Is blue sky and big puffy clouds and the water and the smell of the pines and the birch and the water lapping. And I looked out and I said, "Man, it just doesn't get any better than this." Right? Well, maybe you'd prefer a castle in the Rockies. This is Glen Eyrie, the headquarters of the Navigators. And if you're wondering if it's really in the Rockies, and we're just in the foothills of the Rockies. The next slide shows you something of when you're at Glen Eyrie and you have a free break and you want to go for a hike, you go up about 1,000 feet. And so this is Glen Eyrie. Or maybe this, I haven't hit yours yet. I've got one last one, and that is maybe you'd like an island in the Caribbean, which isn't bad. Now maybe there's something else you can think of. I tried to get as much. I don't have the seashore. I thought of events. You know, Ben Roethlisberger holding the Super Bowl trophy, Mario Lemieux holding the Stanley Cup, and I realize this will be irrelevant for most of you, Willie Stargell holding the World Series trophy. Because it's about that long ago that the Pirates, and most of you are going, Willie Stargell was when? 1980, and I realize most of you are going, that was a long time ago. If you're a Pirates fan, you know it was a long time ago, right? And Byron Curtis remembers, right? And Yahweh had nothing to do with it, right, Byron? And it gets to that point where you can't imagine anything better. And one of the reasons that I want to talk about some of this morning is that when you pick your favorite experience or your favorite place, and then you think about the conventional picture of heaven, you know, you get wings and a harp and you sit on a cloud. And I hope it doesn't sound too unspiritual, but that just sounds really boring. It just doesn't sound... I think I'd rather be in the Adirondacks, right? And people have a variety of pictures that has distorted what heaven is all about. And the interesting thing is, you can't find a lot written about heaven. That is, ultimately. We sort of have this ethereal kind of a picture. Some people sort of consider heaven sort of an eternal church service. Or maybe your view of heaven is it's an eternal chapel with me talking about red dots. Okay, I happen to have my own portable red dot, so if I carry it with me, people say, where are you from? I say, I don't know, but I know where I am. Right? I'm right here, because it says so. There's my red dot. Right? And you can begin to understand why people go, this just doesn't seem to have something that's particularly appealing. And I've been thinking a lot about this. Actually, the idea for this message came last summer when I was in the Adirondacks and started thinking, it doesn't get any better than this, and begin to think, something's wrong with that picture. Randy Alcorn, in a new book on heaven, says, what we have assumed about heaven has reduced it to a place we look forward to only as an alternative to an intolerable existence here on the earth. Only the elderly, the disabled, the suffering, and the persecuted might desire the heaven that we imagine. The Lord's Prayer concludes with, for yours is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. What are we praying for? We're praying for the culmination, the finalization of redemption. Which leads to me, I was trying to put this in a series of questions, like, so where will we be, and what will we do, and how can I be sure, and who's going to be there? Well, let's start. Where will we be? Genesis 1 and 2 begins in a garden. Revelation 21 and 22 ends in a garden, in a city, in a kingdom. So the bookends of the Bible is a garden. It's a garden with all kinds of fascinating things in it. The Bible, particularly the book of Revelation, pictures a new heavens, a new earth, and the new Jerusalem. Or the way in which I was trying to summarize it, here's a wonderful way to summarize it. Heaven is the resurrected Jesus, together with his resurrected people, living in a renewed creation. And suddenly, the ethereal image gets driven aside by something that is much greater. It's a renewed creation with no more curse. We cannot even begin to imagine what that is like. The concept of a new heaven and a new earth is first introduced by Isaiah. Introduces it in Isaiah 11, and then in Isaiah 65. Picked up by Peter towards the end of the first century, saying we look for a new heavens and a new earth. And then Revelation 21 and 22 describes it for us. But the picture is an earth that is redeemed, renewed, and delivered. The earth that God looked at and said, behold, it is very good. And if your concept of heaven is ethereal and does not include the earth and the physical, that means that the creation that God said is very good, because Satan has had an impact on it and it's tainted with sin, if your vision is ethereal, then God has abandoned the earth. It's a failed project. Well, we'll just have to give up on that. Let's just take them all to heaven and give them harps. God's power isn't particularly impressive if that's your view of heaven. Nor is God's glory particularly being manifest, because it means there's something God could not finish and complete. If God gives up on the earth and abandons it, Satan has a major victory. But that's not the picture. It's a picture of a new earth, the renewed earth, with all the effects of sin gone. Well, what will it be like? And this is one of the reasons the verses from Revelation are so important. See, when we think about heaven, I'm talking about the final, the culmination, it's not so much that we go up as it is that heaven comes down. That what God did in the incarnation, the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. Or Eugene Peterson's message, moved into the neighborhood. And actually Eugene Peterson's the message in Revelation 21 said, and God came down and he moved into the neighborhood and he lived with men and women. That's a different picture. We don't go up, he comes down. We dwell on this earth and God dwells with us. And it won't be boring. Every breathtaking view that you can imagine is simply a foretaste of something to come. Every meaningful relationship that you have enjoyed is simply a foretaste of something to come. Every wonderful experience that you have had is simply a foretaste of something to come. Every taste that you have savored, my wife will tell you, whenever we go out to eat and they look at all the exotic things on the menu, she says, "What are you going to have?" And I say, "Prime rib. I'm not spending this much money to experiment with my taste buds. I want prime rib and I want it medium rare, and you don't have to like it when it's oozing. It's mine." Right? Or I can think, you know, way back, my grandmother made the best dumplings. Right? Some of you didn't know what dumplings are, but that's okay. Right? So you can think of, oh man, these cinnamon, oh, you should taste my mother's cinnamon rolls. So there's always this is the fourth, oh, I got something better than that. Whatever it is, there is something better yet to come. There are going to be tastes in heaven that you've never imagined. Everything that is here that is positive is simply a foretaste of what is to come. And the Bible describes the new heavens as a wedding banquet. There's feasting and there's dancing and there's celebration. I don't think they're sitting around there with long faces and somebody starts to dance. Oh, I don't think they ought to be doing that. It's a wedding banquet. You expect joy. You expect celebration. Isaiah 11:6 adds one other thing. The wolf will live with the lamb, the leopard will lie down with the goat, the calf and the lion and the yearling together, and a little child will lead them. The cow will feed with the bear, the young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox. There's a famous painting that's a sort of a stab at this. It's called The Peaceable Kingdom. And you can find a variety of versions of this. And if it were darker, and you could see that a little bit better. But you'd say, there's a little child down there in the lower right-hand corner. But you can see the leopard in the front. I went to the zoo last Christmas time with my granddaughters. And when the leopards are a lot bigger than I thought they were. And the lion is a lot bigger. And when the lion roars, the entire zoo roar. Everybody knows. I can't quite do Ian, you know, Spartans, what are you? Right? But what's happening? There's a cow. And there's a lion. And they're not in danger. Why not? It is a restoration to Genesis 1 and 2. But it's a restoration magnified. It's not merely Genesis 1 and 2. It's something much better than that. Right. Well, what is it we'll do then? Right. Well, imagine meaningful work with no curse. Flower beds with no weeds. Grass with no dandelions. Imagine relationships with no sin. Not only do you not have to deal with the sin of others, even as Avery was getting to in the prayer, you don't have to deal with your own. There's no jealousies. There's no arguments. Why? Because sin has been removed. That's what the scriptures are talking about. We can enjoy a variety of experiences. We can enjoy people. I think it means we can enjoy sunsets and sunrises and the colors and the smell of the flowers and the trees. And we can enjoy being with God. And rather than being boring, it's absolutely fascinating. And it will never cease to be fascinating. Well, this leads to a fairly major question. So how can you be sure? How do you know Smith isn't just dreaming this all up? How do you know John wasn't just making this up because he was really depressed about being persecuted and he was trying to think of something better? The New Testament gives us the anchor. And the anchor for all of this is the resurrection of Jesus Christ. In 1 Corinthians 15, Paul says, "If Christ has not been raised, you are still in your sins. And we are of all people most to be pitied because we put our trust in something that's not going to happen." And it's the resurrection of Jesus that guarantees that sin has been forgiven and that believers will be resurrected as well and be able to enjoy fellowship with God and with one another. And the fact that Jesus has died not only brings the resurrection of the believer, it brings the renewal of the creation. This is the guarantee. Believers will be raised. I've not read a lot by others about the nature of the resurrection. But I've read enough that believers' bodies will be made new. During this week when I was reading, one of the things that was kind of interesting is that some theologians across the spectrum were arguing that since your DNA peaks at about age 30, that in the resurrection, your resurrection body will be about age 30. Now, I think that sounds really good, as a matter of fact. I want to know if I get my hair back. Okay? Things like that, you know. There's lots of fun you can sort of have with that, you know. But here's the key. No more deformities. No more disabilities. No more deficiencies. Many of you heard Devin's testimony a few weeks ago. The renewed Devin will have perfect sight. Some of you have family members. Some of you have grandparents or parents with Alzheimer's. In the renewed heaven, their minds will be clear. Their eyes will be clear. Their hearing will be clear. I mentioned last year my friend George, a 300-pound Serbian steelworker who eventually died as a result of his diabetes, but he'd had one leg completely amputated. George loved to dance. Next time I see George, when I see George in the new heaven, George will be dancing, but he'll be on both legs. Johnny Erickson has a great story about that. She, as a quadriplegic, was speaking to a school of students with mental handicaps, and she said, "And in the resurrection, I will have a new body. I will be able to dance, and I will be able to jump and run." And then she looked at them and she said, "And you will all have new minds." And they understood enough to cheer. And that's what the new heavens and the new earth is all about. No disease, no deformity, no disabilities. Everything is removed. There's no more crying, no more pain, no more death. How can I be sure? Because Jesus Christ came and made his dwelling among us. He died on a cross to pay the penalty for our sins, and he was raised again and ascended at the right hand of God, from where he will come again and bring about this whole renewal. That's the critical piece. Who will be there? Well, Western culture sort of has a default. Well, everybody's going to go to heaven. It doesn't matter if you're Michael Corleone, how many people you've killed, you still get the fancy funeral in the church. Doesn't matter if you're Tony Soprano. You can still, when you die, you get a fancy funeral. The default position, according to the scriptures, is not heaven. It's hell. As a matter of fact, Revelation 21 makes that clear. It makes a distinction. Those who are persistent, outwardly wicked, will not be in heaven. The only ones who will be in heaven will be those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. The Lamb that we began talking about in the collect, who was slain before the foundation of the world to purchase for God people from every tribe, tongue, race, and nation. The Lamb who died to set people free has also died to set the creation free. But those who are in heaven give themselves no credit. Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and honor and glory and praise. And I know from time to time, some of you run into people and you get the impression that their confidence in heaven is because of how wonderful they are. And I'm sorry, that's not the gospel. And I know sometimes on this campus, some of you who are struggling where you are in your relationship with Christ have had other people look down at you as though you're inferior and they're better. On behalf of Jesus, let me apologize, because they did not understand the message. Those who are in the new heaven sing praise to Jesus because it's of grace, and they understand the only reason they are there is because he has qualified them. They have not qualified themselves. But this leads me to a question. It leads me to a question for those of you who may not have yet come into a relationship with Christ. When you're believing friends, you're believing classmates, you're believing team members, you're believing family is in the new heavens, will you merely be a fond memory of their time on earth? Or will you be in the new heavens with them? You can only be there through Jesus Christ. And Revelation closes with a wonderful promise. The Spirit and the Bride say, come. Let him who hears say, come. Whoever is thirsty, let him come. Whoever wishes, let him take the free gift of the water of life. Revelation closes describing this wonderful picture, and it invites you to be there. It invites you to come to Christ. It doesn't get any better than this. Oh, yes, it does. Better than you can imagine. The picture gives hope. The picture gives a warning. And the picture gives an invitation. For yours is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen. David?
Let's close with Psalm 73, with God's promise to hold our hand, to be with us, and to take us to glory bright. Let's sing the first and third verses of Psalm 73.
Yet evermore I am with thee. Thou holdest me by my right hand, and now even thou my guide shalt be. Thy counsel shall my way command, and afterward in glory bright shalt thou receive me to thy side. They perish that are far from thee, low in their lewdness they shall die, but surely it is good for me that unto God I should draw nigh. I refuge take in God the Lord, that all thy works I may